Audi, and welcome to Bombsta, an Aboriginal news magazine program that features news, current affairs, a focus on community and culture, spotlights on entertainment and great tunes, and every flavor from Aboriginal artists. I'm your host, Jennifer Atwasagay. News from east to west today, but first we'll start in Ontario, where a First Nation on Manitoulin Island is the latest to get the nod from the province for a small wind farm. Climate change is a real issue for coastal communities, and a new network has been formed on the east coast to address climate change and help communities prepare for the inevitable. And then over to the west coast, the city of Vancouver is hoping its new project will help bridge the gap between Aboriginal and immigrant communities, and in the Northwest Territories, meet the latest Aboriginal recipient of the Order of Canada. And south of the border, a Native American civil rights march is being organized. All these stories, plus great tunes, coming your way after the news. Here's your national Aboriginal news. The Halibut Band is on hold. The band in Newfoundland was supposed to be created by this spring. There's a lawsuit now pending, spearheaded by Calvin White. And according to the Georgian News, White is an elder and founder of Halibut First Nation Watch Group. He's suing to halt the creation of the band until all membership applications submitted prior to the November 2009 deadline have been reviewed. Now, the Mi'kmaq members will have to wait for the band to become formalized in order to gain status under the Indian Act. A spokesperson for the Department of Indian Affairs has told the newspaper that while a motion is being considered in court, the government will not be proceeding with the establishment of the landless band. A grey whale that was washed ashore in Victoria, BC, was given a traditional burial by a local First Nation. The whale was given its burial April 10th. The whale had been attracting hundreds of spectators, but people were touching and taking parts from it, which First Nation leaders felt was disrespectful. It was decided that the whale should be moved from where it was washed ashore at East Sook Park at the Beecher Bay First Nation under the supervision of the staff from the Department of Fisheries and Oceans. After the whale decomposes in a few years, the skeletal remains will be given to Vancouver Island University for research purposes. Experts believe the near-adult male died of starvation. In Ontario, a First Nation on Manitoulin Island is going ahead with its wind power project. It's not a large project at 4 megawatts. However, Chief Joe Hare says when the project goes online, band members will see the benefits on their electricity bills.
I will be introducing a hydro subsidy program for the members of the community so that, their hydro bill will be subsidized in some part, to some degree anyway, from the revenue we generate.
Hare says the wind project should be fully operational by September of next year. The Order of Canada medals have been recently awarded, and among the recipients, Fred Carmichael, one of the founders of the Aboriginal Pipeline Group. Northwest Territories Premier Floyd Rowland says Carmichael has been a role model for many, including himself.
He's been an inspiration for many people, myself included. He watched a lot of us young fellows, as we'd say, grow up, and to see him involved right from the trap line, going into business, starting an airline company, then getting involved in the political scene at the Aboriginal government level.
Fred Carmichael, himself a modest man, on receiving the Order of Canada.
It feels good. I mean, certainly, honored to receive such recognition. I always feel there's many other people that every bit as qualified to receive such an award, but I guess only some of us are the lucky ones.
The Order of Canada medals were awarded April 7th. Fort Nelson First Nation is reeling after the lack of consultation over the development of a sex-related business on First Nation land. Bombsta Co-op student Deidre Conton has the details.
The Fort Nelson Council voted 6-1 this week in favor of the changes, despite overwhelming public opposition to the plan. Councillor Doug Roper, the lone politician who opposed the changes, told media he has called for a police investigation to inquire into the council's move. He believes that there is influence behind the council's decision. When Mayor Bill Streeper was told of Roper's call to investigate his council's handling of the bylaw amendments, he said, "Until someone can supply one solid proof, I have no concerns that any councillor acted outside his boundaries." Chief Kathy Dickey and her council of the Fort Nelson First Nation were stunned to learn about the city's plan. Even more so when they learned there were intentions to build an escort service zone right beside a school on their land. Councillor Doug McKee attested to an escort zone being placed beside a First Nation school, but said council would be willing to change that. Chief Kathy Dickey remarked that the town and her band made an agreement last summer on common development goals to protect shared family values, which makes the council's move to allow sex-related businesses all the more shocking. Fort Nelson First Nation in northern BC is comprised of Dene and Cree Nations, and the community is adjacent to the town of Fort Nelson. For Bombsida, I'm Deidre Compton.
The City of Vancouver is sponsoring Dialogue Circles. It's a 16-month project with an aim to bridge the gap between Aboriginal and immigrant communities. Baldwin Wong is the city's social planner. He says the circles will help the city create a document for future reference.
These will be small groups facilitated and really bringing both Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people together to talk about their experiences living in the city and particularly the story and share with each other. And that discussion would also help us develop another document which will capture these stories.
The program will cost nearly $400,000, with the City of Vancouver kicking in about $80,000 plus some of its staffing resources over the next 16 months. Staying in BC, First Nation leaders in the province have requested the BC Supreme Court to certify a class action lawsuit to stop the devastation of wild salmon by fish farming, that from the Vancouver province on April 13th. The paper further reports 20 leaders spoke out against open net cage salmon farms in the Broughton Archipelago off northeast Vancouver Island. The group is hoping a class action lawsuit will be a quicker way to save wild salmon and at the same time assert their rights to the salmon fishery. The lawsuit also seeks an injunction against new salmon aquaculture permits in the area, as well as a declaration from both levels of government to regulate salmon farms so they don't impact wild stocks. The certification hearing before the BC Supreme Court Justice Harry Slade is set for 9 days. NAMGIS Chief Bill Cranmer told the paper, since the fish farm started, he's noticed the destruction of shellfish beds, the sea lice killing salmon smolts, and the decline in fish returning to the streams. Communities along the St. Lawrence will benefit from a new research network project. The project by the University of Prince Edward Island's Institute of Island Studies and Environmental Research Studies Program and the Mi'kmaq Confederacy of PEI are working together to support climate change adaptation in coastal communities of the southern Gulf of St. Lawrence. Dr. Irene Novacek is with the University of PEI's Institute of Island Studies. She says the study will help communities identify areas that will be impacted by climate change.
At the community level, we can build capacity for making decisions around land use and development, especially along the coast, where we expect that increasingly there are going to be real problems with sea level rise and flooding and coastal erosion and seawater coming into wells and freshwater systems.
Novacek says First Nation heritage sites will also be identified, and she adds the research study will produce a toolkit for other coastal communities to utilize. She expects the toolkit to be complete in about 2 years. Aboriginal peoples earn an average of 70 cents for every dollar non-Aboriginals earn. That's according to a study from the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives. The study, The Income Gap Between Aboriginal Peoples and the Rest of Canadians, released its key findings April 13th. Among the key findings, the median income in 2006 for Aboriginal people was nearly $19,000. That's 30% lower than the $27,000 median income for the rest of Canadians. The gap persists on First Nations. In urban reserves, people earn 75 cents for every dollar a non-First Nation makes, and that number drops down to 53 cents for rural reserves. The study also reveals Aboriginal women are getting high school diplomas and university degrees at a higher rate than Aboriginal men. And part of the answer to solving the Aboriginal income gap, the study points to education. And the study reveals that Aboriginal women who graduated with at least a bachelor's degree now have higher median incomes than non-Aboriginal Canadian women with the equivalent education. And south of the border, it's promising to be the largest gathering for the rights of Native American people. It's called the Native Blood Civil Rights March. Terry Nichols is one of the organizers, and he's with the Green Dot for Earth organization. And Nichols says they want sovereign nations reinstated with its treaties.
There are over 240 Native American tribes around the United States, what is now United States, for instance, that had Native American sovereignty treaties, government over 100 years ago, who have been broken up and their sovereignty agreements taken away from them and their treaties broken. along with their land. And so it is our focus to restatement of those sovereign nations from the U.S. government and to have that reinstated.
The Native Blood Civil Rights March will be held in Washington, D.C., August 17th to the 19th. Nichols says the group will also be looking to meet with congressional leaders and U.S. President Barack Obama. Nichols adds the dates were chosen to be as close as possible to the date Martin Luther King gave his famous civil rights address, I Have a Dream, on August 28th, 1963, at the Lincoln Memorial. And that's your National Aboriginal News.
Places to go, people to see that I don't know. Fresh air, a new ground to walk on. Got the warm sunshine tugging at me. The road ahead is all I see. Good times waiting my arrival. It's been a long time coming. Doesn't come every day. Got taken now, can't throw it away. This ain't no time for hesitating. Sometimes it's money, sometimes it's fame. And it ain't easy when you're chasing a dream. So close, but you can't always touch it. When it's in your hands, you just gotta love it. Oh, life's calling. Gonna be the same. I go dancing in the pouring rain if I want to. Free to be what I wanna be. Ain't nobody stopping me. No one telling me what I can do.
Yellowbird with Life is Calling My Name. Chagee First Nation on Manitoulin Island in Ontario will see its wind farm project fully operational by the fall of 2011. The community has recently been awarded a power purchase agreement from the province as part of its Green Energy Act. Chief Joe Hare says the community is happy to have approval for its 4-megawatt project, and the community will also see their hydro bills go down through a subsidy program to be introduced when the turbines go online.
There were a number of applications from Manitoulin Island. We were one of only two that got approved to sign on to a contract for a power purchase agreement. And ours is a 4-megawatt project. We've been working on it for a number of years, and we finally got approval, and we're very happy about it.
What does that mean to your community? Does that mean your community is going to get off the grid or is selling power back?
We are selling power back because 4 megawatts would produce in excess of what the community needs. So we have to be able to sell the electricity produced back to Hydro One.
And what does your community think about this?
Well, I hope they're happy. There's always a few dissenters in every camp, but by and large, a majority of the members of the First Nation are happy with it. I mean, they have to be happy with it because it's not a, you know, a huge project that takes anything away from Chiging and, you know, the aesthetics of the area. So, the other reason I think they will be happy is that I will be introducing a hydro subsidy program for the members of the committee so that, you know, their hydro bill will be subsidized in some part, to some degree anyway, from the revenue we generate from the project.
Well, that sounds good. And along with the hydro subsidy program, are there going to be any extra jobs?
Oh, no. No, this is purely, you know, an income generator. There might be one job attached to monitor the windmill turbines, and then maybe to administer the distribution of the subsidy. But I had only proposed the idea last September, and then we have to develop a city bylaw or code to determine levels of subsidy and so on. We didn't want to get into it right away until we knew that the project would in fact become operational. So we know that now, and we'll be working towards working out the details of a subsidy program.
Okay, and just going back to when we were talking about there's no matter what, there's going to be dissenters in any kind of project. What were some of the things that people were opposed to? Just the aesthetics, or did they think about some other health impacts?
Well, the dissent was more on the basis of the project. You know, there was a choice to go to an area of land that was higher, which was not the land was not on reserve proper, and which meant that the First Nation Chiging would have to pay a lease fee for having the turbines located on this off reserve property. And then there were those that wanted the land, and the reason you know that particular piece of land was selected initially was that it had the best wind regime, which in turn generates into more you know, generation, better generation, and better returns. But there were those that felt that it should be on First Nation lands proper, and that's where it got moved to originally. And the wind regime is not as good, but it's still economically feasible.
And so that's where it's going to be?
That's where it's going to be.
Okay, and so when are your turbines going up?
Well, we think, you know, they'll be in the spring of next year, and it should be fully operational by September of next year.
That was Joe Hare, Chief of Chiging First Nation on Manitoulin Island in Ontario. He was discussing the 4-megawatt wind project for the community. Climate change is affecting many coastal communities, and many communities are unprepared for those changes, but perhaps they will be able to benefit from a new research study. The University of Prince Edward Island's Institute of Island Studies and Environmental Program has teamed up with the Mi'kmaq Confederacy of PEI. They're helping to establish a research network to support climate change adaptation in coastal communities. Dr. Irene Novacek is with the University of PEI.
We have been working together with the Mi'kmaq Confederacy and some big watershed associations, especially the Southern Gulf of St. Lawrence Coalition for Sustainability and a number of other universities, to develop plans for a project where we would work together with local band councils and municipal councils and watershed organizations and test and develop and adapt tools for decision making and information gathering and ways of putting together traditional knowledge with scientific knowledge and the types of things we can find out through social science research, so that at the community level, we can build capacity for making decisions around land use and development, especially along the coast, where we expect that increasingly there are going to be real problems with sea level rise and flooding and coastal erosion and seawater coming into wells and freshwater systems.
So are we already seeing those types of changes along the coast?
We are, in fact, yes. Rates of erosion in the southern Gulf of St. Lawrence have doubled in the last decade. And the strait, the Northumberland Strait, the fisheries have taken a turn, and I think that is in part due to the fact that the rates of erosion north of there, all along the New Brunswick coast, Gaspé, and up through the St. Lawrence River are really huge now, like homes are falling into the river and stuff. So that puts a lot of dirt into the water. And what we're seeing in the Northumberland Strait, for instance, is that places where fishermen used to go for lobsters that had nice clean rocks or that had Irish moss or kelp or other good habitat are now covered in mud and silt and no longer productive in the way they were before. Fishermen have noticed that, you know, in the fall when they're pulling nets, their hands don't get as cold. The water is warmer than it used to be. Fish aren't necessarily spawning where they used to spawn. Conditions really do seem to be changing. And, of course, this winter we had so little ice in the whole Gulf of St. Lawrence that there was no place for the seals to pop. And we've been lucky that we haven't had any real major northerly storms.
Mm-hmm.
But on a year like this where there's no ice to protect the shore, if we get big storms, winter storms coming out from the interior of the country, the damage to wharves and homes along the coast and beaches and coastal habitat can be enormous.
Yeah, that's a lot of changes. And it also seems like people are unprepared for some of these rapid changes to the environment.
I think we're really unprepared. One of the areas in which we are unprepared is that we've been a bit complacent. You know, we just let governments make decisions for us. But with this type of thing where, you know, people's homes and businesses and community infrastructure, community halls and wharves and churches and graveyards are at risk and could be flooded or eroded away very rapidly, we really have to get ways put in place, frameworks and processes where people can really work together and pool all of our knowledge and our resources and establish priorities. And 'cause some things need to be moved back from the coast.
Mm-hmm.
Some things are going to have to be sacrificed because we won't have the resources to move them or to protect them. In some cases, you can do something that will protect you against erosion a little bit for on a temporary basis. And where there are opportunities for that and where there are resources available, people really have to figure out, you know, where are those really critical places that we have to protect at least, you know, for a few years until we can do something else. Where people have areas of the coast that are sacred or really important for cultural purposes or for recreation, we have to start thinking about, okay, if we lose that, where is there a place inland where we can gather that medicine or do those ceremonies? And if that, we need to protect them and reserve them now so that they don't get built over by subdivisions or paved, or if it's forest land that doesn't get cut down and, you know, turned into money. If we're going to need it in the future as a place where we can pray or something, we need to think about protecting those alternative places now.
That was Dr. Irene Novacek with the University of PEI's Institute of Island Studies and Environmental Studies program. She was discussing the research network that has been established with the Mi'kmaq Confederacy of PEI. Novacek says the study will produce a toolkit for coastal communities, which will be ready in about 2 years. Nominee Digging Roots with These Hands from their latest CD, We Are. In Vancouver, there's an exciting project underway, and perhaps it's the first of its kind. The city is sponsoring dialogue circles between various Aboriginal groups and immigrants. The project's goal is to bridge the gap between the two communities because both are the fastest growing demographics and don't have a lot of opportunity to interact. Baldwin Wong is the social planner for Vancouver and spoke with Bom Sida on April 14th.
We just launched this formal launching it yesterday. And this has been quite some time in the making, in fact. And it's the first attempt, quite a unique, groundbreaking project for us to engage in, is to really look at how to build stronger, better relationships between Aboriginal and the people, and particularly immigrants in the city, and two of the fastest growing demographic groups in the city.
Who thought of that and why?
They're really various reasons, but I can maybe speak to a couple here. Some years ago, the city actually, through social planning, we worked on a project called Storyscapes, and that's actually looking at exploring some of the early relationships between a local Aboriginal community and other migrant groups and communities, and we uncovered a lot of really important stories that haven't been heard before. And then the cities into the city really don't have the knowledge or understanding or information about First Peoples and First Nations. And we really need to do something in terms of bridging that gap. And so, you know, different things combined, and we have the opportunity to get the federal provincial government funding support to launch this project, and that's why we have the project.
Okay, and I understand that there's going to be dialogue circles.
Yes. So actually, a very key part of this process, we believe, sharing of people's own stories and experiences. So right after the launch, then in over the next few months, we are having 8 dialogue circle groups happening around the city, and they are in various locations. And these will be small groups facilitated and bringing both Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people together to talk about their experiences living in the city, and particularly the stories they can share with each other. And that discussion could also help us develop another document which will capture these stories.
And what kind of stories have you been hearing that maybe people don't even know about each other?
Well, for example, in Vancouver, there are 3 local First Nations, the Coast Salish First Nations. And the Musqueam First Nation, some of the Musqueam people actually have other ethnic heritages, for example, that we know of. But that wasn't really well known to others. So in the storyscapes, for example, when we interviewed elders and others, that's those kind of really interesting growing up experience in the city where they have shared identities with a stronger Aboriginal identity, but also they have other heritages. So that those are some of the stories that we are hearing now.
And perhaps that will help get rid of preconceived notions of what different First Nations, Métis, and Inuit are.
Yes, partly that. But really, very importantly, there's another part of the history, which is that in the turn of the century and in early periods of the last century, when some of the migrant people come to Canada, to Vancouver, that there's a lot more interaction and engagement with the local Indigenous community. And that kind of interaction seems to be not as strong in the last number of years. So we really want to go back into also look into histories and uncover some of those kind of aspects of relationships.
Yeah, I remember reading some recent fiction about some of the relationship that the Chinese community, for example, had with the Aboriginal community during the Depression, where the communities really supported each other.
Yes, we certainly have heard more of that, too. One very pretty powerful story with a local Chinese veteran group since the 40s after the war. They have always, actually, in every important function they host, they've always invited the Aboriginal veterans, actually, to be part of that. I think they really recognize the importance of that relationship, and so we really hear different aspects of those kind of community, inter-community stories.
And do you think with the city's growth that's how some of those relationships or those interactions has been lost?
I don't know whether it's lost in the sense that it's just not as explicit maybe as in the past. The city's immigrant population is pretty robust at the moment. I mean, half of the city population actually can be described as immigrants, meaning they are born outside of Canada. So in terms of just numbers, there's a great number of people coming in, into living in the city. But on the other hand, we also have lots of Aboriginal and First Nation people coming to settle in the city. And then we have the local First Nations. So relationships are still kind of, I think, between individuals happened. But I think we just need to have a greater sense of, or broader sense of how communities interact with each other.
That was Baldwin Wong, Vancouver City social planner. Wong adds the project will be ongoing for the next 16 months. Wong says they hope to get good participation from all communities in the project, and Bomsida will continue to follow this story. Fred Carmichael has led a long career in the Northwest Territories, including starting his own airline industry, and is one of the founders of the Aboriginal Pipeline Group. And most recently, he is the recipient of the Order of Canada, an award given to Canadians by the Governor General in recognition of lifelong contributions or if someone has made a difference in society. Fred Carmichael is one of those Canadians. Northwest Territories Premier Floyd Rowland has known Fred Carmichael for many years and comments on Fred's Order of Canada merit.
Mr. Carmichael indeed has received the Order of Canada, and thankfully I've known Mr. Carmichael for quite some time. I was quite a young fellow when he initially started, while he was born in the Delta, and when he started flying, I can recall trips that he used to make for people's family when we used to live out at Reindeer Station.
Has he been any kind of influence or inspiration to you personally?
I say yes. He's been an inspiration for many people, myself included. He watched a lot of us young fellows, as we'd say, grow up, and to see him involved right from the trap line, going into business, starting an airline company, then getting involved in the political scene at the Aboriginal government level.
And what do you think of him receiving the Order of Canada?
Well, I think it's very good to recognize people like Mr. Carmichael for the work they've done and been involved in from the various earliest days. Many would say that in his generation to our generation now, he's seen it go from the fur industry into the wage industry, as we would call it, and helped many people along the way as just a guide in the sense of helping young men and women find their way, as well as through the businesses that he was involved in. And even in today's environment, talking about what the future may hold with the Pipeline Group, for example.
That was Floyd Rowland, Premier of the Northwest Territories, and now Fred Carmichael on being awarded the Order of Canada and the work he has done throughout the years.
I was born in the Klavik, Northwest Territories, up in the Arctic, and my main background is aviation. I started out as a trapper, no success at that, so I started flying for a living and did that for about 55 years now, but I've retired from commercial flying about 10 years ago, and 8 years there, about 2008, I guess, I came out of retirement and took a position with the local tribal council, the Gwich'in Tribal Council. And my mother is Gwich'in, and elected as the president of the Gwich'in Tribal Council, served there for 8 years, and also I am working as from that position in July of 2008 as well. Since 2000, I've been working with the Aboriginal Pipeline Group, where we would be one-third owners of the Valley, coming from the Arctic coast to the Alberta border. I'm now chair of the board, so I keep myself busy.
Apparently, and you also are the recipient of a Order of Canada.
Yeah, that's right.
How does that feel?
Well, it feels good. I mean, certainly, honored to receive such recognition. I always feel there's many other people that every bit as qualified to receive such an award, but I guess only some of us are the lucky ones.
And I think one of the bases for the award was your work with the Aboriginal Pipeline Group, which you were just talking about. So how did those negotiations go to be able to own now one-third of the Mackenzie Valley Pipeline?
Well, the way it all started is back in 2000, the Aboriginal leadership of the Northwest Territories got together and decided that if there's going to be a pipeline across their land, they wanted to have some ownership and have some say. And as a result of that, we put together the Aboriginal Pipeline Group and negotiated with the producers for a one-third ownership in the pipeline, and we were successful in those negotiations, and we are full one-third partners in our own way, and once the pipeline is built, we will be receiving one-third of the revenue generated by the pipeline. And the reason I'm pushing so hard for it, and so are the majority of the Aboriginal people in the territories, is that we've lost our economic base. Our people were self-sufficient in the past. They had, a good trapping industry, hunting and trapping, totally independent, and they lost their trapping industry, mainly due to the anti-fur movement. And as a result of that, there's no other industry, there's no mines, there's nothing up here other than government. A lot of them became very dependent on government social welfare system, which is not good at all. So we're striving to build an industry. I firmly believe that we must have a solid economic base for our people to become self-sufficient again, regain their pride, and we need to create a good future for our children, grandchildren, and future generations. So we see this pipeline as the first step towards building a solid economic base for our people. And at the same time, we have, because we are partners in the project, we have some say and control over what happens on our lands, and it's very important, as you know. The environment, the land, and all that's in it is sacred to our people and very important, and we need to make sure we have controlled development, but we have to have development in order to move towards self-sufficiency.
Mm-hmm.
This pipeline, that we need help from the south as well, and you know, we need support, and we've been looking to the government of Canada here. We're not asking for a handout. We're just asking for some sort of a loan guarantee, which we probably will never draw on. And this project's not only good for the Northwest Territories, it's good for Canada. I'll just give you some examples. For the Northwest Territories, that we'll increase the GDP by about $70 billion. And for Canada, $90 billion. And the tax revenue for the Northwest Territories is $1.5 billion. For Canada, $10 billion. In addition to that, you know, we're creating over 1,000 jobs Canada-wide. So this is a win-win for all. And I think, you know, with the economic slump we've gone through, I think it's good for Canada. And I think the Canadians to the south of us should rally behind this project because it's beneficial to them as well.
That was Fred Carmichael on recently receiving the Order of Canada. Now here's Waiting for Change from the Shane Anthony Band.
Everybody wants to know where you're gonna go, and if you got room, can you take me, please? There's gotta be a song about you and the way you light up the room. In the slipstream of your smile, I lose myself for miles. 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 Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm waiting for a train. I'm waiting for some rain. I'm struggling to find somewhere to change. I'm waiting on these bar stools to empty up all these fools. I'm hoping to find somewhere to change. Somewhere to change. Somewhere to change. Though you slip through the door, we know what for. You're gonna take, because for us it's much too late. We drunk your beautiful, we crowd you with words and books. And when you step out of the air, we know you disappear. We know you disappear. We know you disappear. I know you'll disappear. Yeah, yeah. Waiting for a train. I'm waiting for some rain. I'm struggling to find somewhere to change. Waiting on these bar stools to empty up all these fools. I'm hoping to find somewhere to change. And someday I've got to change. It's much, much too the same. I sit back on words and things you never heard. Well, I got thoughts that sewer. The hue you got your moves. And the way you're dancing there, it puts so much to spare. Waiting for change. I'm 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 waiting for change. Waiting for change. I'm waiting for change. I'm waiting for change.
Go south of the border where it's promising to be the largest gathering for the rights of Native American people. It's the Native Blood Civil Rights March, and Terry Nichols is one of the organizers, and he's with the Green Dot for Earth organization.
Native Blood Drive is actually going to be the 17th, 18th, and 19th, so that we can fit in all the participants that we want. It's going to be quite an exciting affair. We're bringing in Native American drummers and dancing groups from all over North America. We're going to have noted speakers nationally as well as politicians who are supporting our movement. We'll be speaking through the course of the days. I will be speaking. The principal chief of Cherokee Indian branch, principal chief Billy Chance, will be speaking as well. And Native Blood Civil Rights March on Washington, D.C. is for all peoples of North America, right now, in that we're trying to get a voice out and organize against discriminations against, as Native Americans.
Okay, and can you describe what some of those discriminations currently are?
Well, yes. For instance, there are over 240 Native American tribes around the United, what is now United States. For instance, that had Native American sovereignty treaties, government over 100 years ago, who have been broken up and their sovereignty agreements taken away from them and their treaties broken, along with their land, and so it is our focus to restatement of those sovereign nations from the U.S. government and to have that reinstated.
Has that been tried before?
It has been tried on a smaller scale. This is the first time that we have tried organizing all of the tribes from around the United States for a single voice at Washington, D.C., and we're very excited about this. We're looking at initial numbers of anywhere from 1 million to 2 million people coming for this three days. It's very exciting.
And how have you been getting the word out?
Through public relations, public affairs releases, social networking. We've contacted all of the Native American tribes in North America, for instance. And in doing so, we've been in contact with groups outside of the United States. So there are groups, for instance, in Canada, Mexico, Germany, and a number of other countries who are going to organize similar events on August 18th in 8 different countries around the globe, and we're trying to expand on that right now so that they can show their support to us as well as those people that will be in Washington, D.C.
And are you expecting any groups from Canada to come and attend the event in Washington, D.C.?
Yes, we are. We have received support letters from a number of groups and persons from First Nations peoples from Canada that they will be coming down to attend as being part of some gatherings up in Canada. Exactly where they're at and what's going on up there right now, I'm not quite sure. But yes, a number of Canadian groups have signed on with us.
That was Terry Nichols, co-organizer of the Native Blood Civil Rights March, and it will be happening August 17th to the 19th in Washington, D.C. You've been listening to Bomsida with Jennifer Ashwasige. Bomsida is an Aboriginal news magazine program which includes current affairs, arts and entertainment, and a cross-genre of music from Aboriginal artists. Bomsida means walking together in the Anishinaabe language. Music for the program is courtesy of Burnt Project One. If you have comments or story ideas, visit my website at bomsida.com. That's B-A-M-O-S-E-D-A. And thanks for listening to Bomsida.